Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Sam in the Morning, only on LA Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. We're back to you live. Today's Friday, January 12th. The year is 2018, in case you're still in last year. We're well into the year. I'm back. I'm feeling great. And people tell me that when I do the show, I'm like really uplifted all day, and I have to agree. I'm joined by Kay Brandt. Welcome to the show. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And I always love having Kay on the show. A lot to say.
Yes, always a lot to say.
A lot to say. And we also have a fascinating guest in the studio. We're going to be talking to him about a cool movie he's made. It's a pretty heavy film.
Yeah.
You know, I saw the trailer. But that's the thing. You know, you have short films. You got to focus on the acting,
yes.
You know, because there's not much time for special effects and things like
right.
that.
Right, that's how I feel about my films, too.
Yeah, not even a budget for those. So,
yeah.
You know, you focus more on the relationships and stuff, so, and on the story, you know. So,
yeah,
we're looking forward to that. He'll join us in just a couple minutes. And so, Kay, how's it going? You ready for the weekend?
Oh, I'm so ready for the weekend.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
It's been a long week for you.
Yeah, it really has. It's been a topsy-turvy, up and down. There's a lot of different things going on.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. It's better than sitting around doing nothing, you know.
I never do that.
Yeah, yeah. I know. I'm going to use this weekend to relax a little bit and, family and stuff, you know. So I'm not, like, really going anywhere or anything,
right.
You
well,
know.
Well, you've had a very tough emotional time.
And stressful couple of weeks
mm-hmm.
since my dad passed.
Right.
But I'm here. My beard is growing, and it's prickly.
I'm going to take a picture of that today.
Yeah, right. Well, I'm going to take pictures as it progresses. You know, I already posted one on Facebook, so we'll see the progress by 30 days.
Right.
I'm going to look like a rabbi, or
right?
Something. All white or like Santa Claus, depends on how you look at it.
Right.
But we'll see. But then it's going to come down, all of it. You know, people tell me it looks good, but I don't know, man. I'm not into facial hair, you know.
I know. I think that it does, though.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll try it. You know, maybe after that I'll try a trimmed one.
Yeah. You said you didn't.
Now it's growing wild. And someone asked me why in Judaism you don't shave when your father dies for 30 days, but I couldn't really explain. I think, and it's crazy that we don't ask why, right? But maybe it's just one that I haven't had a chance to ask, but I think what it is that you're not supposed to make yourself to pretty yourself up, you know?
Uh-huh.
It's like you're supposed to just let things go, not shave, not, you know. I mean, some people, like the religious ones, they don't even take a shower for a week. The same clothes.
I don't know
everything.
What to
can
think
imagine?
About. No, that's horrible.
Yeah, I know. But
anybody not
that's
taking
why I'm not
a shower
religious.
For a week.
I can't
I don't
deal
care
with
what
that.
Your excuse is. Get in the shower. Get clean.
I know, but that's how some people mourn.
You got to get in an elevator with other people. Have some,
well,
you
don't
know,
go
care
anywhere
about
in
it.
That week. You pretty much stay home with the family. You
I
know?
Couldn't even stand myself
nobody
if I was like, not
it.
Taking a shower.
I know. That's why we did.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
and
yeah,
we changed our clothes and everything. But
thank God.
But the things I can do, I'm doing, you know.
Okay.
Had to go to temple a couple times. I mean, my brother wanted me to go every day, but I'm just not into it, man, you know. But it's amazing how the first thing that comes up when someone dies is religion, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't matter what religion you're in, but
mm-hmm.
immediately people go to, what are we supposed to do now?
Right.
What is a tradition? You know, what do we do? And
right.
you go to religion.
Well, like I said yesterday, for my family, it's cannolis.
Really? Well,
you know, it's somebody dies, who's bringing the cannolis?
Right.
And it's a major deal. The cannolis don't show up. No, I'm just kidding. I'm making all that up, but it sounds good.
But people did bring a lot of food, a lot of food.
There was an actual fight. I mean, I'm basing it on something real.
Yeah.
You know, I remember that there was an issue.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Sometimes it can happen in families. I mean, it does happen all the time.
It's not really about the cannolis. It's just that was an excuse to let, was an outlet for the emotions to come out.
Right,
when the
right.
cannolis didn't show up from the person who said that they were going to bring them, it created a catalyst.
Whoa.
You know what I'm saying? For pent up, you know, because... You know, everybody's being polite and friendly and loving to each other, not wanting to stress out the situation because there's been a death in the family and there's a funeral and all this stuff. But, you know,
yeah.
the first person to drop the ball when it came to supplying the buffet, you know what I'm saying? Got the fury of hell.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. From my grandmother.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we got a chance to spend just the brothers and my mom. You know, I have two brothers and my mom, and we spent a lot of time together alone. And
yes.
it gave us a chance for everyone to pitch in as far as to what they remember, what this, what that. And it was like putting pieces together, you know, and we got like a complete story of our lives, you know.
It's so cool.
So it was cool, like a little puzzle, you know.
Yeah.
And so what happened after that is I realized a lot of people started getting close to each other, you know, my brothers, my kids.
It's good.
Close to me, so yeah.
Hopefully it will last.
I know. I know. I know. Give me some sympathy, kids. You know?
Or just like remember this moment and let it change us for the better.
Yeah.
You know? I hope that works out for you.
I know that people will actually appreciate the time together, you know? There's nothing like family. If your family is cool. But there are families that are tough, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you're from an Italian family, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Wow. So you guys gather around the table all the time and eat, right?
We did.
Yeah.
We don't do that anymore.
Like, no? It seems like, you know, when I used to watch The Sopranos, every scene is around the table eating.
Well, see what happened is that the generations before I showed up, there were always lots of kids. So there was bigger families.
Right.
And then when my mom when she left the nest and went off on her own, she only had me.
Right.
So I'm an only child.
Ah.
I have half siblings that were discovered, and that's another story completely, and that has nothing to do with my mother, has to do with my biological father. But but the generations have dwindled. So where my grandmother had five children, she only got three grandchildren, though. And it was me and two others. And but I was the only grandchild for 20 years before my nephew was born.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, like,
so
you
got a lot of attention.
Two out of her five kids had no children by choice.
Really?
Yeah.
Two of the five.
I think that's what happens when you're just surrounded by all this, you know, like all these other kids and how it was in the 50s and 60s and the 70s even. They just felt, I know that those siblings that did, those my aunt and uncle that didn't have any kids by choice. I know that for them, it was a sense of just needing to be free of all that.
Right.
Because always having to share, always having to do this. My grandfather built their home in Long Island, New York on his own. With his brother.
Really?
They built this entire home. And we're talking about a fairly large ranch style home, one story, but with a big basement underneath, which is common in New York, especially on Long Island, on the East Coast.
Right.
And on a big piece of property that all the other properties around them have sold, and like builders came in and chopped up the properties because there was significant pieces of land that each of these homes sat on in this area in Huntington, Long Island.
Yeah.
And, you know, my grandmother never sold the house. She didn't really make many changes to it. The home was built well the first time and has stood the test of time. And that was built in the 60s.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I was actually thinking about this. I saw like a video of this woman that actually built her own house. And I'm like, what a great idea. You know, I mean, you can save a lot of money that
way. I watch those shows all the time.
Yeah.
With all the technology that has come along, it's really not that big of a deal. But back in the day, it was a hammer and wood.
Right, right.
You know, maybe a little cement.
I know. Now they have like a 3D printer that lays the cement down. Have you seen that?
Yes.
It's unbelievable.
The biggest mistake my grandfather made was only putting one bathroom in the house. There's a bathroom in the basement and a bathroom upstairs. He had five kids.
Oh, God.
So you can imagine.
Yeah,
okay. When I say about my aunt and uncle not having children, the fact that they get to have a bathroom all to themselves without having to share with anybody else, I think runs deep in their psyche.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And has affected their choices as adults to just go kid free.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
Wow. Well, you know, I mean, that's, you know, I mean, yeah, I don't know about kids, you know. I mean, what I mean is some people just are not meant to have kids.
And, that's true.
And it's good when the ones that know it don't
actually
have kids.
Live by it
and don't
attempt to. Yeah.
You know, some people are not cut out for it, and that's
fine.
No,
they're not.
You know?
And there are a lot of people who have kids and then think, oh, You know, like, yeah, I may not obstacle. Have been the best person to have right. children. And
I know.
To deal with that.
I know people who view their kids as an obstacle. I'm like, how terrible, how tragic, you know?
Well, but are you, is that day in and day out? Or
no, no,
just
no,
uncertain?
Not day in. I'm just saying I know somebody.
Yeah.
You know, that one particular
yeah.
person.
Yeah.
So.
Not everybody's, it's hard. That's a full-time job.
Yeah, yeah. Kids. But you got to think about it before you do it, you know? But at any rate, we'll get to our guests in just a moment. I just wanted to bring this up because this is like kind of very sad. Eric Clapton is claiming that he's going deaf. Eric Clapton, for those of you who don't know, is probably one of the best guitar players ever.
I agree with that.
Right? Mm-hmm. He's a great singer, too. And he's 72 years old, and I guess he's connecting this to aging now.
Of course.
And
he was around
terrible.
Very large amplifiers for the majority of his life,
right?
blasting
in your ears. Yeah.
Yeah, there's only so much that your body can take.
Yeah. We're not cut out for that kind of... For that level of decibels, you know?
Well, we're cut out for short periods of time, and yeah. then you deal with everything. See, everything we do up until we reach our 60s is, you know, it's from 60s on that you're dealing with the repercussions of however
exactly,
you live your life.
Exactly, so. You know? But it's also because we live longer, you know? I mean, the thing is they say that if we didn't die or we lived a long time, everybody would end up with... like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and stuff, because the body would just degenerate,
yeah.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
That's what happens. So some people end up dying or don't get it or stuff. But if you live long enough, everybody would get the degeneration of the nerve system.
Exactly.
Nervous system. So, but anyway, so that's Eric Clapton. And now, after the sad news, we're going to bring in our guest right now. We're sitting here patiently. And we're really excited to be joined by Kevin Wilson, Junior.
Thank you.
Kevin, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Nice to meet you.
You too. And it was funny. I was expecting a different movie today. I told you. I mixed up the guests and stuff.
Yeah.
So Kevin shows up. I'm like, I was expecting two people. He's like, no, it's just me. So then I realized I misscheduled. But I got a chance to catch up and everything. And you're a writer, producer, and director
yes.
of films.
Yes.
You created a short film that we're going to be talking about in just a moment. But have you made any feature films or just short films?
No, I'm a graduate film student at New York University. So this is a short film that I made in the program.
Oh.
My first feature film I plan to shoot this summer.
Oh.
Yeah, so I've been making short films for about 9 years now.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow,
so,
wow.
But this is the one that... that received the most critical attention and the one that I'm most proud of. So,
yeah. Well, it's a pretty deep, powerful film. And
Thank you.
Yeah, we'll delve into it. So are you originally from L.A.?
No. I'm originally born and raised in North Carolina on the East Coast. And I lived in New York. I live in New York now where I'm in school at NYU.
Oh, really? So
yeah,
you're still
in LA
school,
visiting,
right?
Yeah.
Oh, you're visiting.
Yeah, yeah. I'm still in school. I'm going into my last semester now at NYU, so I'll be graduating in May with a Master in Fine Arts. So.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So is this an undergraduate program?
It's a graduate program.
A
master's degree program.
Wow. And where did you go before? Also to NYU?
No, I went to school in Greensboro, North Carolina. It's a historically black college and university called North Carolina A&T.
Uh-huh.
It was founded in 1891 after Reconstruction.
Wow, that's a long time ago.
Yeah.
It was founded as an agricultural school, and then it developed into a technical institution as well. So it's the producer of the largest a number of black engineers in the country. So
really?
Yeah, it's a very
wow.
strong program. Ronald McNair, Jesse Jackson all attended this school. Ronald McNair was the first black man in space to explore space. So it's a pretty strong program with rich history.
Right.
I studied journalism there. And television production. It has a strong program there as well. And I'm proud. I'm a proud graduate.
Yeah, I mean, look, you went to good schools and stuff. But did you do well in high school as well? Is that what helped you to get into
well,
a good school?
Well,
high school is high school.
Yeah. High school, you know, I did good enough to get by. It wasn't right. like I didn't get a 4.0 GPA, you
right.
know. But that was because you know, my mom demanded a lot of me, but I wasn't as focused in mathematics and in sciences when I was in school. But it wasn't until I got to college that I really buckled down. And in my first semester at A&T, I didn't do too well. And I remember my mother called me on the phone. And my mother is, she's an educator. She has her master's degree. She's a college professor. And
she expected a lot of me.
And then when I didn't do well my first semester, she called me up and she said, okay, you know, if you keep this up, you're going to fail out of school. And what are you going to do then? Because you're not coming home.
Whoa. How you got to raise kids.
Yeah.
You definitely do.
And I buckled down and I did what I needed to do. And, you know, I think I'm very grateful for her for doing that, for that tough love. And
that's awesome. Yeah. Do you have siblings?
I have a half sister by my biological father, and she lives in Raleigh, North Carolina. She's older than I am.
But you are an only child.
I'm a mother's only child.
Yeah. Wow.
I'm a mother's only child. She was a single parent until I was 14, and then she remarried to a wonderful man. Who raised me as his own.
That's amazing. That's a good thing.
You're very fortunate for that.
I am. I'm grateful. I am.
Wow. Seems like you came out a decent human being, you know what I mean? And that comes from good parenting, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? Obviously. So you owe a lot to your mom and stuff.
Yeah.
So she's an educator?
Yeah. So she's a paralegal, and she got her master's degree in criminal justice from North Carolina Central University, another historically black college in North Carolina. And she was a college professor there for many years before going back and working at a law office in Raleigh, North Carolina, full time.
Yeah. So she realized early on education is important, huh?
Well, oh yeah, from the beginning.
Very good, man. You're very fortunate, because not many kids get this kind of guidance from their parents.
This is
true.
Sure.
You know, sometimes we just, especially this generation, we let the kids get by with so much.
Sometimes
you know?
They get this kind of guidance and they ignore it.
Yeah, right.
That's true. Yeah. It does take a great deal of personal accountability at that point because, you know, it doesn't matter what you instill in your kids, especially when they become an adult. You know, at the end of the day, they have to make the decision to take those lessons and apply it to their own lives for themselves.
Right. You can't make them do it, you know. Right. And then once they're past 2021, forget about it. They don't even listen, you know.
Earlier than that in some cases.
Yeah, right. So that's very cool. So, but you realized you're not really engineering and stuff like this. You're more a creative type.
Yeah.
And so when did you first show interest in making films?
Well, I started out acting when I was 7 years old in little shows around North Carolina. So from the time I was seven, and then in high school, I went to a high school with a very strong performing arts department. And in that program, from the ninth grade and the 12th grade, we were required to write 12 short scripts a year.
Wow.
And so that really kind of developed my my writing sensibility and so then I was really interested in writing. I wrote a few feature-length plays. But it wasn't until college, when I was acting in college, in my sophomore year, I was a journalism major at the time. And I graduated with a degree in journalism, but the head of the theater department wanted me to transfer into the theater program because she said that if I was going to be acting in their plays, then I needed to be a theater major. Mm-hmm. Instead of doing that, I decided to write my own play and direct it. And that play was about the story of Emmett Till. And it did well at the university. And we started traveling along the East Coast touring the play. And it was then that I found my love and passion for being in control of the narrative and the stories that I wanted to tell.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And in the summer of 2009, I watched Do the Right Thing by Spike Lee. I watched it every single day for the entire summer.
Whoa.
I would go to I was in summer school. And
record, I much prefer She's Gotta Have It.
The original one?
Yeah. But he made that in film school.
Yeah. It was like, so She's Gotta Have It is good. But if you ask...
It was so creative.
Yeah, it was.
And he was breaking ground.
Yeah.
And he had so much style and flair that his promise as a filmmaker was evident from that film.
Yeah. It was a strong film, and he made it for really cheap.
With school grants.
Yeah. And
NYU, wasn't it?
He went to NYU. Yeah, he went to NYU Graduate Film School as well. And that's one of the reasons why I ended up applying, just because I'd seen Do the Right Thing, and I ended up reading all of his books. Actually, I have in my bag right there, it's a book, his diaries on when he was making She's Gotta Have It.
So that's
cool.
Like,
I read all that stuff in 2009. And
there was so much controversy when that movie came out.
Really?
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
When not she's no, going to have it, but do the right thing.
Oh, do the right thing. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So much controversy.
Yeah, for sure. And people were thinking, you know, executives were saying, oh, it's going to start a riot.
Oh, yeah, it did for a little while.
Well, it's like, I don't know. It's like, you know, the movie, I think, started a conversation, you know, and it just kind of resurfaced feelings that already existed. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't, I don't know if it was the movie that started any controversy, but rather it was the movie that kind of brought up feelings that already existed that did. So it's like, I don't know, those feelings were already there. And it was like, we're seeing that sort of thing today, I think, you know, where, you know, with you know, with the division that's in this country right now, it's like it's revealed, right? It's I don't blame Trump 100%. I don't think that he is the cause of the division. I think that he exposed the division that was already present.
Right.
Yeah.
Of course, he has a lot. Of course, he has a lot to do with that. But it's like, you know, those feelings are there, and a lot of people, I think, keep it suppressed until they feel emboldened and until something makes them feel confident enough to share.
I think that with Trump, though, it's a there's many levels to that.
Yeah, for
the
sure.
exposure was like it was telling in so many different ways on so many different levels.
I agree.
Yeah, it wasn't just about the fact that we want this wealthy billionaire white man to lead the country and not a woman.
Yeah.
It was, you know, the fact that we're fairly enlightened about who politicians are and what they're about, and he fit the non-politician. And we always, as a culture, want to believe that somebody's going to come along from a different area, from a different area of business, and that's going to be the answer to solving our political dilemma is having somebody in the office who's not a politician, and that's just a bunch of crap. Now, where do we go from there?
Well, okay, but let's get away from Trump right now.
We're talking,
talking about Kevin Wilson.
I gotta tell you, like, almost every show that I've co-hosted with you, Sam, for the past several months, somehow Trump's name comes up.
Well, because he keeps himself in the conversation. He keeps himself.
But how can you not?
I mean,
you go to CNN.com, the whole front page is just Trump. Every headline.
Oh, I know. And the Twitter, I'm looking at this and everybody, it seems like 90% of people are making fun of him on a daily basis. Has that ever happened with a president before?
No.
There's been mocking. There's always been political comedy. There's always been, you know, satirical cartoons and stand-up comedians and the whole thing that mock a president. But this is like a different
Plus, we're
level.
Very divided, too. So, you know, I mean, the parties are really polarized. Right now.
Yeah, I just feel numb. I feel like I'm going through the next 3.5 years totally numb.
Sure.
Right.
Totally with a president that I don't believe in at all.
Yeah. But he knows how to keep himself relevant. That's the thing. He's been in television for decades. And you know, he knows that any publicity is good publicity. And that's how he got the presidency.
He's also been the creator of his own destiny 100%. Sure. I mean, he is truly. I went to interject this real fast, and I'll let you have the mic again. But I went to a museum. I was telling you about this last week over the Christmas break, the holiday break, called the Museum of Failure in downtown L.A. There is a whole wall dedicated to Trump because and you're going to love, don't cough. Because he has had a horrendous track record of failures. The Museum of Failure has a shrine to Trump and the Trump franchise. Not just what he's done, but what his kids have done and what his ex-wives have done. Marla Maples, I mean, the whole thing, you know, like he has literally had one gigantic failure after another. Do you know he had Trump vodka?
But he's
Trump
had successes too.
And
you can't discount the successes. And the thing is, people are saying if you haven't failed, you haven't really tried.
But it was one after another to the tune of millions and billions of dollars lost.
Yeah. Right.
And yet he's been allowed to do it again and again.
That's what America's about. Yeah. It's about second, third chances.
Well, there are people
who
get certain chances when they have a certain privilege.
Right.
You know, so it's, yes, America is the land of second chances, but there are certain people, mainly people of color, women of color, women who don't get those chances that others get.
I found it as a filmmaker that I say one wrong thing.
Yeah.
And it's never forgiven.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
My mentor, Casey Lemons, talks about it in class, and she's a very successful filmmaker. But she says there are just certain things that we're not going to be allowed to say on set.
Oh, yeah.
And do on set. Just
oh,
because
yeah.
you know, you're a woman, I'm a black man, and there are certain times we have to bite our tongue when others
oh, yeah.
won't have to. You know?
Oh, I've lived a career of biting my tongue. Mm. The only time I get to let myself loose is here on the show.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
But, well, I think yeah. everybody bites their tongue, doesn't matter what, you know, because
yeah.
It's become very...
When someone else is writing the checks, yeah, you have
yeah.
to bite
yeah,
your tongue.
Yeah,
you got to
yeah,
play
yeah.
the game.
Yeah.
You
but
have
not
to.
Only that, but it's like everybody's just like at each other's throats out there, you know, and everybody's got an opinion and everybody's got that. But, you know, some people don't want to express this because it's too hot. The topic is too hot, you know, and people don't want to get involved in that.
It doesn't even matter for me what the topic is. It's
right.
the fact that as a woman, mm-hmm. I'm not truly allowed to be powerful, strong, or have a strong opinion or state mm-hmm. the truth.
Right. And it's like, if there's a situation, for example, yeah. that someone speaks to you disrespectfully on set.
Right.
Right. You wouldn't be able to respond in the same way that someone
else
may have.
I've had that happen to me many, many times.
Right.
People I've actually hired who think mm-hmm. that I just, as a woman, mm-hmm. and because I like to be light and easy on set, easy as in I don't get caught up in drama. I don't become a dictator.
Mm-hmm.
I just try to let the creative environment live on its own. And so the performers, the actors can organically create characters and turn in great performances. And I find that there are a lot of people, both men and women, who see that as weakness.
Sure.
Right.
That if you're not coming in and going, boom, it's like this, it's like this, it's like this, then they think that you don't know what you're doing. And the times that I am a dictator, that's when everybody's like, ooh, she's no fun.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
she's
sure.
not a fun person. So then I'm fun and people don't take me seriously.
No, right. no, really. You're absolutely right.
Yeah. So, okay, so let's get to your film.
Mm.
So you started going to school and stuff. You made a few films, right?
Right.
And then you made My Nephew Emmett.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when did you make this film?
I actually shot My Nephew Emmett a year ago in January in Mississippi. So it was when I was a second-year student. I'm a third-year student at NYU now, my final year. When you're in the second year of the program, everyone is required to make a short film that's a little bit more ambitious than the films that we made before. So a lot of students end up traveling to different countries, the countries that they were born in, to shoot those movies. I wanted to tell this story specifically because it was a part of me. My mother introduced me to the story of Emmett Till, which is a young black boy. He was 14 years old in 1955. He traveled from Chicago to Mississippi to visit with his relatives. And when he was there, he was at a store. And he whistled at a woman who was a white woman, Carolyn Bryant. And a few days later, he was abducted from his home in the middle
Oof.
Of the night. He was tortured and he was murdered. They found his body in the river 4 days later.
A 14-year-old boy.
14-year-old, yeah, African-American boy, Emmett Till. And his body, his face was so badly disfigured that they couldn't even identify the body. The only way that they were able to identify the body was by the ring he was wearing on his finger.
Oh, shit. Yeah.
The men who did it, two white men, J.W. Milam and Roy Bryant, were acquitted for the crime. They were acquitted for kidnapping and the murder. And then a short time later, they published an article in Look magazine confessing to the murder and detailing everything, how they did it, where they did it, why they did it, and they got paid. So they made money off of the murder. And they ended up living a comfortable life. And
so after they admitted all this, they couldn't be tried again.
No, double
for
jeopardy.
It, right?
They couldn't be tried again.
Right.
You know? And so there are still people who were connected to that case who are alive even after the men had passed away. And the FBI actually opened up another investigation about it in 2005 after the documentary about this murder by Keith Beauchamp was released. But still, no one's really been held accountable for it.
Right.
It's just, you know, it was tragic. You know, the murder galvanized the American civil rights movement. And this was the beginning, you know.
Really?
Things were happening around that time, but this was the spark that
wow.
ignited the flame.
Yeah.
So
That's some spark. So this was, we're in Money, Mississippi, I see, right?
Yeah, it took place in Money, Mississippi.
Right.
Yeah.
What a name.
August 28th, 1955.
So, the irony.
Yeah.
So they obviously were pretty angry, I mean, to kill somebody like that.
Well,
right?
I mean,
what the hell's wrong with people? Why would they do this? I mean, obviously, it's hatred. It's more than just punishing someone.
It's hatred.
Avenging
it's just a hate crime.
Someone,
it's,
you know?
It's hatred. Because there was nothing.
It is.
There was no crime to be punished for. It was just hatred.
Teaching a child about respect, and it went way too far.
Well, yeah, and you know, it shouldn't, you know, there was nothing that Emmett Till did that was disrespectful. You know what I mean? And so it's like, here's a boy, and then there are these unwritten Jim Crow laws which say that a person of color cannot flirt with or speak to a white woman.
Yeah, and there's been many movies about that topic right there in a nutshell.
Well, yeah.
About that relationship when they cross the line and they have the secret relationships, and basically it just shows where we've been in the evolution.
Right, and there are these ridiculous invisible lines that have been drawn from bigots in this country, and when you cross that line, you pay with your life. Right. And there are many people who are lying in the bottom of the Tallahatchie River right now,
yeah.
You know, for that reason.
Mob didn't put there.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, but you know what? That's not very far removed from where we are right now. Just in 2014, Lyndon Lacey in Bladenboro, North Carolina, was found hanging from a swing set.
Yeah.
You know, and he was
like
dating a white woman.
Nothing's changed from the 50s and 60s.
Nothing, right, and that's why I wanted to make this film, because, you know, it's very relevant to a lot of what folks are experiencing today. Their parents, right? You know, my film is told from the perspective of a guardian, right? And there's their parents right now who are mourning the loss of their children, you know, because of hatred. So that conversation has to continue, you know.
Right. But and then bringing that into contemporary times and what's relevant right now, especially in social media. I mean, in my industry, in the adult industry, we've lost a couple of women due to cyberbullying and what's going on Twitter. And it's hard. It's, you have to remember, this younger generation in their 20s, social media is their deciding factor. Mm. It does influence how they feel about themselves.
Yeah.
It does create, and especially if you're emotionally off kilter. And I think that hate goes on in many different ways. Mm. It's not just about race. It's about just being an asshole. Mm.
That's what I wanted to ask you. Yeah. It's like, have you considered, what if, let's say a white kid did the same thing, right? And whistled at the woman, right? Is that what he did? He whistled?
Yeah.
If she had like a jealous husband or something, or a boyfriend, couldn't they have done the same thing?
No. This was...
This was someone not related to her. Is that what you're saying?
No. You're just a 14-year-old kid.
No. The guys.
The murderers.
Oh.
Yeah, the murderers were her husband, but that's the bigger picture is Emmett Till was a black boy in Mississippi who disrespected a white woman by flirting with her. So the punishment for that was...
Death.
Was death, right? And sure, like if a white boy did that, he would not have been killed. Like,
how do you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, if the husband was that pissed.
No, but the reason why we know is there's example after example in Mississippi, in many southern states, not just southern states, but all across the country. We're talking 1955 when it wasn't illegal to kill a black man.
In that time, it was prevalent.
Yeah,
you said about the Tallahatchie.
Yeah, listen.
It wasn't illegal. To kill a white man?
Just to kill... If a white man killed...
I mean, a black man.
No, absolutely not. Listen. Emmett Till's murderers... Emmett Till's murderers... And I understand you didn't know, so I'm very passionate about this, but Emmett Till's murderers were two white men who killed a black man, and they were acquitted by an all-white, all-male jury who deliberated for less than an hour.
And that's happened a lot.
It's a common story.
That's happened
a
lot.
And many movies have been based around that core.
This has happened many times. Yeah. And, you know, Emmett Till was from Chicago. And so, that type of atmosphere wasn't as prevalent in Chicago. So he wasn't aware.
Yeah.
He wasn't
in the
aware
South,
that
yes.
when you travel to the South. But his mom tried to prepare him for that. But he just wasn't aware.
Right.
So, yes, like in certain parts of the world, there are white kids who could, you know, playfully flirt with a woman and get away with
it's
it.
It's still like that, though, in some areas of the South.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, in Mississippi right now, the Confederate symbol is still on their state flag.
Yeah.
Right. You know what I mean? So, right. I mean, and that is a symbol of racial oppression and bigotry and death. And you know, in the Confederacy, we know, fought to uphold the institution of slavery. You know, and that is still a symbol on their state flag. So it's like those feelings are still present. You know, we want to start a conversation to see how that we can get past them and rise above it. And like and I do think like Emmett Till's family mustered the strength to get past that. You know, and I think they made decisions that helped start a movement that changed the world, which is the most important part.
Right.
But as she said, those things are still happening. You know? And in Emmett Till's case specifically, it 100% was because of the color of his skin. You know.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've researched this a lot. I'm not going to dispute that. By the way, folks, we're talking to Kevin Wilson Jr. He's the filmmaker that made My Nephew Emmett, which we're talking about right now, an award-winning short film. What award did you get?
So we won the gold medal, the Student Academy Awards, in October. Which qualified us for the Oscar, so we're in the Oscar shortlist.
Wow! Holy shit!
Yeah,
that's super cool.
You see, his publicist always sends us like Oscar winning, so you have a good chance of winning.
Yeah, but you know, we'll see. Hopefully, you know, but the important thing for me and the exciting thing is that the awards have created an opportunity for me to continue to share the film with people. To continue to talk about Emmett's legacy and why it's still important, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And he gives me.
He was way too young. I mean, to deal with this, you know. And it's all that innocence and you know. I mean, it's heartbreaking.
Yeah,
it really is.
Yeah. And
you know, so you decided to capture this. Did you? So the film, what part of the story are you dealing with there? I mean, I saw the trailer. I saw this white man coming in and abducting the kid, right?
Yeah. I'm telling the story from the perspective of Emmett Till's uncle, Mose Wright, who was Emmett's guardian at the time when he was visiting in Mississippi. Emmett's uncle was the one who opened the door and was forced to allow these men to walk inside of his home and was forced to allow the men to take his nephew out. So he had to watch as his nephew was driven away.
Wow. That's horrible.
And yeah, so it's a 20-minute narrative from his perspective as he deals with the really difficult task of having to make the decision of do I let these men take my nephew or do I allow these men to kill everyone in my household?
Right.
Which
is what they would have done.
Right, exactly. Exactly. They had guns. They had the law on their side.
Motivation and the intention, the will to do it.
The will to do it. There you go.
Yeah.
They went in there ready to kill any and everybody who stood in their way. You know?
Oh, yeah.
Man, that's terrifying, man. What the kid must have gone through, you know?
Yeah, but then, you just think about the psychology of psychological profile of the white man who did it.
Right.
You know, like, what the hell? Where did they ever think? Talk about rage. Talk about hate. And then power and numbers to believe that it was going to be all right.
And that's a thing, right? And it's just like George Zimmerman who was confident enough to kill Trayvon Martin because he knew he knew the legal system.
Yeah.
He knew how to get away with it. You know what I mean? So there are, I mean, again, like, you know, we bring it to contemporary times. It's the same thing. It's like when folks are out here, not just killing black people, but just anyone, right?
Yeah, gays.
Right, exactly. You know, they're doing it because they really believe.
Sam.
They really believe, right. And they really believe that they could get away with it.
And
in many cases they do, right?
Right, but would you argue with the fact that the majority, I mean, at least I've read that, the majority of black deaths are done by black people, right?
And the majority of white deaths are done by white people. It's a crime of proximity.
Right.
Black people live in black neighborhoods.
Right,
white people
live
in white neighborhoods. So
there's a problem there.
No. And that's the thing. It's like we can't turn the conversation into a conversation about black on black crime or white on white crime.
Won't. No problem.
Let him finish.
My point is, you know, that what we have to deal with is what the actual issue is. Like, if we're going to talk about the police killing unarmed black people or unarmed people without accountability, then that's what we have to deal with. The issue of black on black crime is a non-starter. It's not a part of the conversation. Mm. That's a completely different issue that we have to deal with.
You All know right, I mean? I'll stand corrected.
No,
all right, so let's go back. No, I understand.
No, I'm just talking because I've heard people bring that up a lot, and it's the reality. You know, whenever we talk about a person of color being killed by a white person or by a white police officer,
and
it becomes a different thing. It turns into a conversation about black on black crime. When the reality is the reason why. You know, you have black on black crime and white on white crime is just because of it's a crime of proximity. It's like when you have an all black neighborhood,
right?
Black people in one area, there are going to be black people killing black people, and we have an all white neighborhood and white people
and black cops killing black people too, right? Happen.
If it happened and that black cop has been held accountable for that.
Right.
Right. You know what I mean? But that's what I'm saying. I mean, the whole thing with the police and all that, you know, I don't know. But you know what? We're getting too sidelined by this. Yeah.
Well,
I like that you started, that you're bringing up the conversation, and it's very important.
It's a conversation without resolve, though, and I think that's what bothers me the most is that there's no way that we're really going to resolve that. It takes each one of us becoming more empowered and less caught up. And I don't just think this has to do with race, and I don't think this has to do with sexuality. I think that in many ways it just has to do with our general perception of people we don't know that don't fit a normal, quote unquote, normal. I mean, it's even the same thing with body image for people who may be overweight or people who maybe you have to fit into a certain thing. And if you don't, there's something wrong, and your life is spent trying to become this other thing that society says that you should be.
Exactly.
And we're in a really amazing time period where that divide, that those boundaries are fading because of social media, because of YouTube, because of the power of the human voice.
Sure.
Underneath it all, Jewish, female, black, gay, overweight, this, that, whatever, it doesn't matter. We are beating hearts with, if you believe in a soul, we have something that animates us and that we are a purpose that we're carrying out. We have brains. We are a species on this planet, and we have always been different. There has always been other countries. There has always been different nationalities. This thing between black and white or gay and straight, women and men, it's all so fucked up. It's the human drama that we create, but the exterior is just the exterior. Yeah. It has nothing to do with anything else. Yeah. But bottom line, and what drives most of the dysfunction and mental illness in this world is fear.
It is. And hate.
Mm-hmm. And if we can just evolve past that.
You hit it.
And look, on a daily basis, even small things, you know, like you learn to just turn the switch off. That's the easy access is anger. Mm-hmm. The easy emotion is rage.
Mm-hmm.
The harder emotion, the harder path to choose is of peace, acceptance, love, gratitude.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I wanted to ask you about the film real quick. Did you... because we only have a few minutes left. And we're talking about the film My Nephew Emmett. Fascinating story, tragic story. How did you... Let's give a shout out to some of the people that worked with you on the film.
Yeah, yeah. So... I made the film at NYU, so the crew was the predominant crew was NYU students. But
so cool.
My cinematographer Laura Valadeo, she's one of the most talented cinematographers I think working right now. She's like, I think she's gonna blow up really soon, and she didn't even have to because she was out of the program. She went to NYU, but she's out of the program when I came in, so she didn't have to shoot my film for free, but she shot it for free. Just because she believed in the story.
That's amazing.
And she really, like, she did an amazing job. And so honestly, I don't think I would be where I am right now if it wasn't for her voice and her perspective on this project.
Wow.
And then, of course, Spike Lee gave me post-production funds for the film. Whenever I finished the film,
that's fantastic.
He saw it and gave me a great deal of money so I can do the sound mix and all that.
You know what's amazing about this, and I'm sure you know this, but Sam, is that this is where, you know, I was an executive producer for a long time for a venture capital, not for a long time, for like a year for a venture capital firm in Menlo Park, in up in Northern California. The hardest, the most common thing I saw were filmmakers who were fairly new, and they had no funds because they mismanaged whatever funds they had to finish post-production. So there are a lot of films that end up...
That's exactly right.
Right, that just end up right there. They're done. They're finished. They may need a couple of extra scenes. They may need some added stuff that was overlooked or forgotten or not done during the actual production. But what stops most budding filmmakers, most aspiring filmmakers, is that they have run out of funds when it comes to post-production.
You're absolutely
and
right.
And so they seek venture capital money for post-production. And I worked for venture capitalists who had zero interest in giving finishing funds for post-production. Now, post-production is expensive. That's where the editor comes in. Mm-hmm. That's where all the sound mixing comes in. Mm-hmm. This is where everything that you need to put that film together.
Yeah, that's where you tell the story, right? Yeah. The editor puts a story together.
Sure. But then you have to pay those editors by the day.
Oh,
you have to pay the sound mixers
by
the day.
They're not
cheap. And then you got ADR, and you got you know, all that.
Oh,
and
yeah.
You got to score it. You got to pay for the score.
Oh, yeah.
And then music clearances.
Oh, yeah. Captions,
know?
Titles,
so you
have DNA,
to,
prints,
you have to
and
deal with all of it, huh?
And, you know, market. Yeah, and so, you know, post-production, you're right. Post-production, in some cases, in my case, end up costing more than the production.
Hell, yeah.
You know, and so, and you're right. There are a lot of, you know, young filmmakers and film students who do mismanage their funds and spend everything in production. And then when they get to post-production, they run out of money.
And they also kind of naively think that somebody's going to very willing see the brilliance in their film and write them a check. And it's just not, it just doesn't happen. It's very rare when that happens. And I've seen people who had connections to, who were like the nephew of some guy.
And they still got nothing.
The films never were finished. Never.
Well, you know what? Spike Lee is such a generous man. And he does these advisement sessions where he sits with students one-on-one and he gives you like 30 minutes of your
really?
His time.
Wow.
And then he does that from like 8 to 2, and then he teaches a class from 2 to 5 on every week. And as busy as he is, you wouldn't think that he had the time to do that, but he makes the time for us. And so, you know, he's been mentoring me through the process of making the film, and he's been mentoring me for the past 3 years. And so...
You're very fortunate.
Yeah.
Now,
I'm
tell
blessed.
People, we only have a couple of minutes left. If people want to see the film, how can they see the film?
Well, well, before I say, I must mention one more person. It's
sure.
just Casey Lemons, who is also a fine director, who directed Eve's Bayou and Talk to Me and Black Nativity, some wonderful films. She's also my directing professor, who I did like 17 drafts of the script, and she sat and gave me critiques of all 17 drafts.
I bet.
And she's a working director as well, and you know, so
just so
like
you're
people,
a promising filmmaker.
Well, people
they
giving you their time, I think, is the most valuable
and
thing.
I'm going to add
they
to that,
believe in what
Sam.
You
know, that is one of the best things that any filmmaker can ask for. In that, and when you're grateful for the people that come around you and give their support unconditionally, ask for nothing. They're not looking for a paycheck, and you can trust them.
Yeah.
That is when you have that group. When you have those people around you, because it's few.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Those people that you can really, really trust that are not toxic. They're not reading your stuff and they want to change it because they want something different or they want this. They're really just about what you're doing and they want to make you the best person that you can be.
Yeah.
And then there's that romancing your crew, you know, where you feel like without them, you would have done nothing. And you're so grateful and so thankful for their contributions, like your cinematographer and all of that.
Yeah, she's brilliant.
And so without all those magic ingredients, the magic doesn't happen
at
all.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But so people can... So the thing is, the film is still being considered for the Oscars, so I can't like release it online right now. But what is going to happen is once we find out about that, if it does get nominated, they'll release it in theaters, in 500 theaters, with the compilation of all the five live-action short films.
Okay.
And then, even if it doesn't, get nominated, it's going to be released on VOD platforms, so like iTunes and Google Play and Amazon. And
that's awesome,
man.
I can't wait to see
it. Vimeo pay service?
Yeah, I think they do like the Vimeo on demand. demand, so you can pay for it on there. So so it'll be available on all those. So.
Right, and excellent. Then people can see the trailer where.
Yeah, so it's on Vimeo. So if you go to mynephewemmett.com,
okay,
there's a trailer there on my website, mynephewemmett.com.
Sounds great. And how can people find you? Get a hold of you?
Yeah, my website is directedbykevin.com.
Okay, and social media, are you all over the place?
Yeah, Instagram is at directedbykevin, and then Kevin Wilson Jr. on Facebook.
Sounds
good.
Are you on Twitter?
Twitter, I'm my nephew Emmett, at my nephew Emmett on Twitter. So
You're a fascinating man.
Thank you.
You know, a lot of accomplishment and stuff, and we congratulate you for that and your mother.
Thank
for
you.
Showing you the way. You know?
thank you so much.
Of course.
Appreciate
it. So everybody check him out, Kevin Wilson. Kay, thank you so much.
Thank you. I'd like to make a quick shout out.
Yeah.
It's Friday, and if you're on Facebook, look up the group Wicked Pens. They are a fairly large group of authors. And we do lots of cool things in that group. We do takeovers and lots of promotion and give away a lot of books and interact with readers. So if you're on Facebook, look up the Wicked Pens. And there are
Wicked Pens. I think that tells a story, right?
Yeah, I'm also a member of the Wicked Pens, so you can find me there.
Okay.
And if you're looking for something to read this weekend, find me on Amazon, Kaybrandt, KAYBRANDT, and you can read all of my 26 books this weekend.
There you go, guys. You have something to do this weekend. And when you read those stories, I'm sure you don't just read them, right? It's sort of a companion to some other activity. So whatever you take.
Meant for entertainment purposes.
Yeah, you take that to the bank, folks. Thank you all for listening. Of course, we're back live now every day. So have a great weekend, and we'll see you all on Monday.
Sam in the Morning, only on LA Talk Radio.